Good evening. Can you hold up to God's standard? Were you to die today, would you go to heaven? For most people, the answer is, well, I would like to think so, but there are some people that would actually say, no, I probably wouldn't. I really don't think I would. If that is the case with you, then you need to make things right. First of all, if you already know or if you already have the feeling or stinking suspicion that if you were to die today, you might not go to heaven, there's no time like now to make it right. Have you ever had plans to go somewhere only to have them canceled due to some tragedy, some mishap? I have a customer that a couple of years ago went on a trip on a safari to Africa. And he was telling me all about this trip and how he stayed in this bungalow. He had these pictures of it, and he had pictures of all the animals he killed over there. And it was a really cool trip. And I said, man, what did something like that cost? And he goes, I got a really good deal on it. He said, a guy bought this package hunt that included airfare. It included mounts. It included the game. It included everything. But some tragedy struck, and he couldn't go, so he had to auction it off. And I got it for about a third of what it really cost. Good for one guy, bad for the other, right? I'll never forget, we were watching a movie. Some of you may have seen the movie. It was a movie called Ghost. I don't even remember much about the movie. It was a long, long time ago when I watched it. But there was one scene that I do remember, and I remember it extremely well. It was a scene where this bad guy, the main bad guy in the movie, or one of the main bad guys in the movie, he's trying to kill this person, and the ghost goes in and starts messing with him, starts turning on water and knocking things over in the room, and he's freaking out, and the ghost is right on him and just messing with him, and he runs out, and he runs down, and he ends up getting hit by a car, or hit by a truck. He runs into a car, and then the truck hits him, and when the truck hits, you see him fly over the car and land on the street, but that wasn't him, that was his spirit. The body is laying there between the truck and the car, all mangled, and this spirit gets up and walks over and looks at himself laying there bloody and smashed on the front of this car, and he's looking at himself and he doesn't know what's going on. And about that time, the good guy, the ghost, says, you're dead. And he turns around and these dark spirits start coming up out of the gutters like shadows, and they come and they grab him, and he's screaming and he's hollering, and they're grabbing him and they're pulling him away, and he's looking at his body laying there on the car, and these spirits take him off, and he's fighting, no, no, and it takes him down in the gutter and he's gone. The good guys, when the good guys die, they're escorted up into heaven on a beam of light or whatever. I know this is just entertainment written in some Hollywood studio, but what if someone you loved and you were both killed at the same time, and all of a sudden you see that bright light they're all talking about, and you get excited and you're apprehensive, I'm fixing to go to heaven, and you see this light come down and angels come and they grab you and they put their arms around you and they start to pull you up, and you look at the person next to you and they're not there, they're being dragged away by the dark demons of hell, and they're looking at you in shame, I'm not going to heaven. I don't think that's how it's going to be. I don't think it's going to be that dramatic. And I really, again, that's a Hollywood perception. However, when you think about it, that is kind of what's going to happen, at least the separation part. There's going to be a separation. Those that are going to paradise and those that are going to torments. How many times have you done something you knew you shouldn't have done? Today we see all kinds of behavior in society that is just abhorrent behavior that we look at and we scratch our heads and think, how can we get to this? Talked about that a little bit this morning. If you were in the EBS class Thursday night, Stephen Moody did an excellent job on his lesson, and he listed several new designations, if you will, for sin that the world has taken to renaming. The world has taken to renaming sins, these names that they can name so that they can be more easily recognizable. We've done this before. We've seen society. Oh, they're having a fling. No, they're committing adultery. They're doing, just a little sip. Oh, he's just doing a little social drinking. That sounds clean and pretty and exciting. No, they're committing sin. All the sins, we've always tried to put names on them that make them sound better. Now it's a society that's changed things in a different way. They've named these things different designations, and I claim to be this, and I identify as this, and I identify as that. Here's what I am. This is what I identify. Come look at me. Come join me in my sin. And that's the message that they're sending. It's a scary, scary thing. They're sending out these messages that we redefine sin. We label them so that other sinners can recognize them and participate with them. And when anyone disagrees, you're a bigot or you're a racist. Society is eagerly conditioning us to think of this type of lifestyle as the norm and to accept it. Y'all have to accept it. It's the way they are. They were born that way. You just have to accept that. Sad reality is that if any of these people were to die right now, they will have to make the concession, I can't go to heaven. My question again is, can you hold up to God's standard? Have you ever seen a house as it was being built? They don't just take a bunch of boards and throw them together or pile them up and crawl under there. What they do is they'll clear the land and they'll find a good spot. They'll have to make sure that it's not in the floodplain. They have to make sure that it's a good spot. And they do this and they dig trenches and then they put up forms and then they lay in steel and then they pour concrete and they let that cure and then they start framing the house. Once they get the house framed, they start decking the top and they start putting siding on. And the list goes on and on and on. The steps go on and on and on as to how they build this house. Now, according to RocketMortgage.com. You probably heard of them, but they're just one in a million that give these statistics. But according to RocketMortgage.com, the average cost to build a home as of February of this year was $282,000, $282,299. I was blown away that that's what, and I think that was a 2,100 or 2,200 square foot home. That's the average cost in America today. Now, again, there's a lot of different people that give statistics on this, and the numbers vary. So what I did is I took a number that would fit in and give you a true average of what those were, $282,299. Now, why would anybody go through all of that trouble and all of that expense when you can buy a 10-man tent from Walmart for $99? I mean, seriously. $99 for a 10-man tent. We put 10 people sleep in that tent for $99. Because a tent will not hold up to destructive weather and the ravages of time. It's not going to last. We won't stand up to the wiles of the devil if we don't put on the whole armor of God, and it can't just be a tent. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 11. If we turn with me to Isaiah chapter 59 and verse 1. Isaiah 59 and verse 1. It says here, "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy that it cannot hear." This is a very good passage, for it shows us that God is able to save us no matter how dreadful or how disgusting our deeds have become. No matter how bad the sins are, and I mentioned the sins that Stephen Moody, he went down the list just naming them one after another, after another, after another, after another. These are not new sins. They were all old sins. They have just new names, new designations. But no matter how bad they are, there's no place that you can go that God can't forgive you. Now, this is not to say that, well, then we can do whatever we want, because we know that's not the case. Some people take that to mean, well, I can do whatever I want and God will just save me. I'll just wait for God to save me. It's not, that doesn't work either. It doesn't say that God will save you, but simply that he is able to save you. So how do we know that he will save us or not, knowing that we all sin? Romans chapter 3 and verse 23. And look at the next verse in Isaiah chapter 59, verse 2. Isaiah 59, verse 2. "But your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you, that he will not hear." God can save us from our sins. But we'll have to leave the sinful lifestyle. We cannot remain in the sinful lifestyle. Sometimes this is a difficult thing. We straddle the fence and we teeter back and forth and we struggle and we strive. Just keep the faith and keep pushing. This is how it usually plays out. We love the world, but we realize that that it is evil continually and that we have become partakers with it. So then we turn to God in time of need for help. We obey the gospel. Our lives start to turn around and things start looking up. Next, we continue in sin with the attitude, surely God doesn't expect me to quit overnight. I mean, I didn't get into this overnight. It's taken me all these years, so I surely can't quit right now. Many times that's the way people look at it. I've seen people that stop everything, they drop everything, they change their whole lifestyle, get sick because of their addictions that they were addicted to, that they are turning away from. And I've also seen people just push and push and struggle. And I'm trying so hard to stop this behavior, and it's difficult. Satan is pulling at me harder and harder and harder every day, and I need your help, and I need your strength, and I need your courage. We see how things are. We start looking back. Things are going well. We say something like, well, I know it's not going to hurt to go back and do this just this once. Go get involved just this once. Once we make a commitment to God, then deliberately commit sin, then that is a deliberate sin. When we deliberately commit sin, whether we convince ourselves it wasn't deliberate or not, then it still is. We've broken our commitment. When we buy a car, we commit to making the payments on that car. We're going to finance it for 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, or I'm sure it's getting more and more every day because cars cost so much. Once you sign on that dotted line, you're committed. We're going to make that payment no matter what. And what happens if you miss that payment? You broke your commitment. And they come and say, but you can't repo my car. Yeah, we can. You broke your commitment. We have to understand that when we break our commitment to God, there may be consequences. We don't make it right. In the religious world, we seem to believe that we can go back into sin willfully and God will accept it. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 26. Hebrews 10, verse 26, for if we sin willfully, after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remaineth no more sacrifice for sins. No matter what the sin is, no matter how bad the temptation was, no matter how bad your marriage is or your divorce was, no matter how bad you were abused by a parent or a spouse, no matter how terrible they made you feel, no matter how difficult it is to cope with your drug or alcohol problem, no matter how bad your problems are, no matter how tough your life is, hell is a lot worse. A thousand times worse. There will be no remedy and no end. Once you cross that threshold, there's no coming back. If you'll remember, Lazarus was brought back from the dead. He wasn't brought back from hell. This alone should make us want to serve God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, with all our strength. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1 through 7. We'll look at this passage and break it down a little bit. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1 through 7. This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. From such turn away, for of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women laden with sins, led away with divers lust, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. When we look at a passage like this, we seldom think of ourselves. Because what? We all want to think, well, I'm doing the best I can and I'm a good person. Our thoughts turn to someone we know that practices some of this sinful behavior, but the truth is we can all fall into the trap of being unfaithful to God. We can all fall into one of those categories if we're not careful. Even if we are careful, we can still sometimes fall into one of those categories. And we need to lean on the everlasting arms of God. This passage lays out the chain of events that cause us to grow farther and farther from God. We talked about that a little bit this morning. Because of these grievous sins, the time of their occurrences will be called perilous. That simply means that dangerous, a dangerous time. Anytime anyone practices a sinful behavior or gets wrapped up in sinful behavior, their soul is in danger. And it may be just a little bit. It may be just dabbling, but there's still a bad problem there. Sometimes there were big sins in the Bible that were easily and readily forgiven. Sometimes there were others that were very, very small and seem insignificant. You think about this, and sometimes you scratch your head and say, why is that? Moses murdered a man in Egypt, and God forgave him for that. Yet he didn't get to enter into the promised land because God told him to speak to the rock and he struck it. Sometimes we wonder, how is that? I think it has a lot to do with our attitude and with our heart. Our heart is with God. God saw that those people were penitent and they repented. And He added to them life, or He changed their lives, or He gave to them things. Anytime anyone practices sinful behavior, their soul's in danger. This passage starts out, men shall be lovers of their own selves. This is the first thing we want to look at. Men shall be lovers of their own selves. Well, doesn't everybody love himself? Ephesians 5:29 says, for no man yet ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. From our text, the phrase lovers of their own selves comes from a single word in the Greek. So you see, lovers shall be lovers of their own selves. And it's just one word, philotos, which means selfish. Selfish. This characteristic of selfishness causes trouble because it makes us think that our needs are first or that our needs are more important than others. If you think about this, it is oftentimes selfishness that destroys relationships with our family, with our friends, with our spouses. Selfishness. This trait is usually the cause of all the other negative traits mentioned in this passage. Selfishness. Putting myself first and putting all others last. And you think about if we can conquer this, and most of us have conquered it, when it comes to Christ, put Christ first. Seek first the kingdom of God. Put Christ first. If we can conquer that, then all the others will come to us. We'll be able to put our spouse first, or we'll be able to put our friends first, or our family first, or all. We have a tendency to prioritize. Blood is thicker than water, right? That's the old mentality. These passages, all these negative traits, the next one is covetousness. This is the desire to have more than we need. I know it'd be nice to have enough money to pay all your bills, to have enough money. We see there used to be a show called Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and they showed us how the rich and famous people lived. And if you were to go back and look at those shows, the original beginnings of that show, those people didn't live much different than we live today. Originally, now we look back and then some of those shows, they were like, wow, they have gold faucets in their house. They got these 10,000 square foot house and they got Bentleys in the driveway and they got these servants and they got this, man, they just live high on the hog. Lifestyles of the rich and famous. This is how the rich people live. How does that apply to us? Wouldn't it be nice to have your bills paid? I look at now and people used to think, man, it'd be nice to be that rich. Now, believe it or not, in our society, we look at it different. Wouldn't it be nice to have enough money to help other people? Darla and I watched a movie the other night, and it was very entertaining. It was, I don't know what the show is called. It's a TV show about celebrities helping other celebrities or helping family members or friends or somebody in need. And Shaquille O'Neal was having a house remodeled for his uncle, who he was very close to growing up. And he had a nice house, but Shaquille spent a lot of money to remodel his house and buy him a new car and just did some really, really neat things for him. And, you know, we look at that and say, it would be nice to have that kind of money, to be able to help other people. And we have enough to help other people now. Sometimes we may need to think about that. When we become obsessed with the acquiring of goods to the neglect of good Christian morals, then we have trouble. That's when that that covetousness begins to define us, when we become obsessed with the acquiring of goods to the neglect of good Christian morals. Luke chapter 12 and verse 15. Luke chapter 12, verse 15. Jesus said, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth." We know idolatry is condemned in the Bible, but did you know that covetousness is considered idolatry? We look at idolatry and our first thought is those people that worship the statues or the totem poles or they idolize someone. They go, "Are there any idolaters here in our community?" How long do you have to drive around before you see a car that's covered with Spurs stickers and Spurs flags and the person's wearing Spurs t-shirt and Spurs ring and Spurs shoes and everything Spurs, 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 or Dallas Cowboys, or whoever. Always somebody. Don't give me that look, Wyatt. Always obsessed, okay? So we look at those things and we automatically think of that, and we've talked about that before, is how those are the things that people idolize. They become idolaters of those things and those teams and things like that. But if you listen to Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, Paul's talking about covetousness here, and he calls it idolatry. He tells us, along with some other things, that we need to get them out of our lives. We need to put these things to death. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, he says here, "Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry." Covetousness, which is idolatry. Here's what we have to understand. Idolatry is not the bowing down and the worshiping of Baal. That could be considered idolatry. Idolatry is not the inventing false gods or worshiping the sun, the moon, and the stars, although those things can be idolatry. But idolatry is literally this, because those will fit into this category, but that's not the definition of those. The definition of idolatry is putting anything before God. You're an idolater if you've elevated your spouse to the position that she is queen of everything and she is first and foremost above God and everything else. You're an idolater if you put your husband on that pedestal and elevate him to where he is above all else, even God. That's idolatry. I'm not telling you don't love your spouse, and I'm telling you don't put them on a pedestal. I'm telling you don't put them before God. God first, me second, my family, or my family second, me third after that. Husbands can take note of this: God first, my wife second, and me third. A lot of people, I can remember back in the day, and some of you older people remember, the man of the house would eat first, and he'd come in and sit down, and mom would give him a plate, and dad would eat, and then everybody else ate after that. Mom usually was last. And that wasn't because that's the rule. That was because that's what she chose to do. She put her family first. In a sense, the man put his family first also. He was going out and working 10 and 12 hours a day to support that family. And so you don't want to take anything away from that. Next, we see in our passage boasting, which is right alongside covetousness. Psalm 10, verse 3 says, "For the wicked boasteth of his heart's desire and blesseth the covetous, whom the Lord abhorreth." He boasteth of his heart's desire. Man, I'm going to get me some of that. Man, I want some of this. Oh, I just got to have that. Oh, I can't wait to get this. And he blesseth covetousness, which the Lord abhorreth. Why do people boast? It's usually to get the admiration of others, right? Ask anyone in here who is a sportsman if they have a picture on their phone of a big deer or of a big fish that they caught or of something that they have accomplished. Look at my kid. He said, "Look at that. Man, she got the home run right there. Look, scored the winning point. Look at that right there. We've got it all over our phones." You want to see what's important in somebody's life? Look at what they do. Look at what they love. Open up their photo album. You willing to show everybody your photo album? Absolutely. Yeah, we do it all the time. Hey, check this out. I was going through some pictures the other day before yesterday, and I found some pictures on my computer from when the kids were young, and I was showing them to people in this congregation this morning. Look, here's Allison when she was like this big, and then Wyatt. Here's Wyatt. He was just a baby. Look at these pictures. I have pictures of people from our congregation. Look at a picture of Ivan for 10 years ago. He looked just the same. But we think about the things. What's important? If you keep going far enough, you'll find some pictures of deer on my phone. If you go far enough, you'll find some things that I really want to keep that picture. What are we proud of? We got to be careful that we're often proud of our accomplishments. We encourage our children to do well by praising them when they do good. And this sometimes gives them a boastful attitude. We have to be careful with that. We have to make sure that we accomplish great things, that we don't boast. Others will praise you, and we should let that happen. We need to have a spirit of humility. Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 2. Proverbs 27 verse 2 says, "Let another man praise thee, and not thine own mouth, a stranger, and not thine own lips." Boasting is a difficult thing because it's something that we all sin to do it sometimes, and that we know when somebody's full of it. We know when somebody's full of boasting and it gets tiring, it gets old, and oh, that guy, that's all he ever does. He's patting himself on the back all the time. That's kind of the boasting that it's talking about here. It's interesting that our passage from 2 Timothy 3 verse 2 simply includes proud. Why is proud included with a list of despicable attributes? For one, pride is often the beginning of unrighteousness. Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 18. Proverbs chapter 16 verse 18. Pride goeth before destruction, and an haughty spirit before a fall. Proverbs 29:23. Proverbs 29 verse 23 says, "A man's pride shall bring him low, but honor shall uphold the humble in spirit." I guess this explains why God hates pride. I say that because Proverbs 6:17 lists a proud look as one of the things that God hates. Think about this. How many people wouldn't agree that we cannot have salvation without God's grace? We have to have grace. Most people I know would agree to that. Listen to what it says in James chapter 4 and verse 6. James chapter 4 and verse 6. "But he giveth more grace, wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble." Okay, so he makes a contrast here between humility and pride. "He resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble." The sentiment is repeated in 1 Peter 5 and verse 5. And the reason pride is such a big deal is because it is the opposite of humility. And humility, I find, the Bible says more about humility than almost anything else. A few more things to look at from verse 2 of our passage. It says that men shall become, among these other things, blasphemers. Does anyone know someone who is a blasphemer? We may know someone who's covetous or someone who's prideful and arrogant. Someone we automatically come to mind when we think of those things. Pride, arrogance, covetousness, even covetousness. We can pick people out and say, "Man, that's a very covetous person." But do you know someone who's a blasphemer? We kind of get this look on our face like, "No, not really. I don't know anybody that blasphemes God." If we don't know anyone in this transgression, we at least have heard someone who was blasphemous. For blasphemy is the offering of disrespect towards God by words or in writing or simply being irreverent towards God. Now, this is one that scared me as I read this because I thought of blasphemy as someone that curses God. And I remember reading a story about these guys that were out in a boat, and one of them was talking about there was a storm coming, and he says, "We better get in. That's a pretty bad storm. And say a prayer that we make it in time." He says, "You can pray all you want, because there's no God. If there was a God right now, he could strike me dead." And lightning struck and killed him. Now, that was a story, maybe a preacher's tale. Don't know where it came from, but I can remember people telling that tale and think about that. And that guy was, we want to say, well, this is why that happened to him. Let's suppose that story was real, and that happened to him because he was being irreverent towards God. It was blasphemous. There is no God. If there is a God, so that's irreverence and that's blasphemy. And we think of that as blasphemy as those extremes when somebody calls God out as blasphemous. There is no God. Or I only have one God, and that's my checkbook or whatever, blasphemous statements. But when you look at the definition of blasphemy, simply being irreverent towards God, and what all fits into that? That could be the way that we carry ourselves, the way that we dress, the way that we act when we're in worship or in amongst God's people. I say in church because when I say the way we act in church, we automatically think about in this building, which means nothing. But when we gather together as the church, if we are irreverent towards God, it could be just a simple thing. Think about this. When Moses came up on the mountain, what did God tell him? Remove your shoes from off your feet, for this is holy ground. You can look at that verse over and over and over again. You can dissect it. You can break it down. And the bottom line is this. God expects something from His people. He expected Moses to reverence Him enough to take his shoes off when he came into His presence. This is holy ground. Yes, yeah, so? So take your shoes off. Show some respect. Let me tell you something. I was standing in the foyer. It's been many, many years ago. I was standing in the foyer, and it happened a couple of times, but it didn't happen very often. And I can remember Buddy and Robin were coming in, and the boys were coming in with them, and Buddy was standing there, and as the boys went by, one of them had, I don't remember which one it is, so don't call either one of them out, but one of them had the hat on, and he got the hat off of him and hung it on the hook. And the Lord Duke, one of them, which are turned around, Buddy didn't say nothing. He just kind of pointed at him and hung the hat up and kept on talking. But I can tell you this, you will not see either one of those boys with their hat on in this building. You won't see it. In fact, if it happens, it's an accident and they take it off right away. If another kid their age or younger or even an adult sometimes has a hat on in the building, they will very, very politely remind them, you need to remove your hat. Why? What difference does that make? No big deal. What? A visitor comes in and they sit in the pew and they got a baseball cap on while the worship service is going on? Some people may not think much of it, but I guarantee it, Bo and Duke, it's eating them alive. To see that, I just want to go up and slap them in the back of the head. Why? Because they understand that that is being irreverent towards God, which is blasphemy. These two young boys understand the seriousness of blasphemy towards God. And other people don't. People show up in car wash clothes to worship and they say, it's no big deal. I mean, it's we're a little country congregation. It's no big deal. Maybe you're not spiritually at that point yet where you can see that you need to show reverence towards God. How do we show reverence towards God? By praising Him? Yes, we do. There's a lot of ways to show reverence to God. But keep in mind, there's a lot of ways to show irreverence towards God, and that is listed as blasphemy. That's a scary thought, because I've never given blasphemy a second thought. I'll never blaspheme God. I'm always trying to be right. I'm always trying to do right by God. It's very easy to be blasphemous by being irreverent. I'm going to end with disobedience. This is the last one on our list, for it is, in essence, the word for which all the others are defined. Disobedience, according to Webster's Bible Dictionary, is this: neglect or refusal to obey, violation of a command or prohibition, the omission of that which is commanded to be done, or the doing of that which is forbidden. Breach of duty prescribed by authority. Breach of duty prescribed by authority. And I kept going through this, and this is, again, Webster's Bible Dictionary, but that very last phrase there, breach of duty prescribed by authority, that's disobedience. When God, who is the ultimate authority, gives us something or tells us it is our duty to do this, and we fail to do that, that is breach of duty prescribed by authority, which is disobedience. Now, you may or may not agree that the Webster's definition of this is a good definition because, after all, it's one man's opinion. But how would you define disobedience? Without obedience to God, it is impossible to get to heaven. If we are living in disobedience, we are not holding up to God's standard. Will you hold up to God's standard today? If you have any need, the message is yours. Won't you come while together we stand and sing the song that's been selected?